You're listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson, a space for reflection, symbolic exploration, and the slow emergence of ideas. Each episode invites you to pause, notice, and wander with curiosity through thought, voice, and imagination. To find out more, go to robwatsonmedia.net or follow on social media at robwmedia. Hello, it's Rob Watson here, and it is Monday the 30th of June, and we have a very hot day today. It's about 30 degrees. I'm sat once again at Leicester Cathedral because it's a nice place to sit, and there are plenty of seats around here. There's very few people here today. I think most people have kind of ducked in out of the warm weather. It's 10 past four, and I wanted to carry on with my reflections of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which is the project I've set for the summer to read Jung's commentary and notes on Nietzsche's book, and to try and start to make sense of how I understand what it is about. And I want to try thinking about doing this in two ways. The first way is to, if you like, a scholarly approach, and the second way is more of a therapeutic approach, and to approach this as a combination of the two. Hence the reflection and the dialogue with the text and the recording and the examination of the Jung's commentary and other associated texts. So what I was think I remarked on last week was, or the last episode of this, was that I am reading the book, or I was reading the book, but I found it incredibly difficult to just read from the page. And so what I opted to do was listen to an audiobook version, and I found it much more agreeable to listen to it being read out. And actually that was something that in the introduction, which on the Penguin edition, the audiobook comes at the end because it doesn't want to spoil the plot as much as that is, and some of the key themes that are being discussed. And it says it should be considered less, as a performance, as a text that you have to engage with as a performance, as much as it is a text that you would read and understand. So that kind of has given me a bit of reassurance that on reading it again, and maybe listening and reading at the same time, studying it, that actually being able to adopt that tone and position will be more helpful and useful as a way of opening up the sense of what the Thus Spake Zarathustra is actually about. Plus, of course, you can't read these things in isolation. You've got to read them in the context of Nietzsche's other writings and other figures that he was responding to. So the whole narrative is in... the whole of Nietzsche's work, in a way, is in response to the tradition of Western European philosophical tradition, from Plato and Aristotle through to Schopenhauer, Kant and Schopenhauer and others, and his response to people like Hegel as well, and of which he took a different term. So one of the things to note about Nietzsche's latter approach to writing is that he wrote less, whereas Hegel wrote more. And I've tried reading Hegel, and it's interminable, and it's subclause after subclause after subclause. Whereas with Nietzsche, it's aphorisms, and they're very succinct, and every word is chosen carefully and moderated. And it's something that he kind of, it's laden with inferences and meaning, which don't in themselves explain themselves, but which are situated within wider debates and discussions. So the first approach to thinking about this or absorbing this, actually, interestingly, is not to think about it, but to feel it. So this orientation of feeling is what Nietzsche was actually trying to encourage rather than thinking. And so let's go to Jung. I'm reading Jung's seminar notes on dream analysis from the late 1920s, and they're written in a very, they were taken from notes from seminars he gave, and so they're much more conversational. They don't have the technical language, so they're much more kind of agreeable to read. And he goes into detail about analytical approaches to dream work, from which he explains his thinking about things like the archetype, things like the the process that dreams and the unconscious represent, symbolism. I mean, this is a 600 or 700 page book, and I'm 100 pages into it, and it's actually very enjoyable. But it's also, you know, there's lots of points in Jung's thinking where he brings these threads together. And himself offers, if you like, homilies as to how and why we should think about the unconscious. So, you know, Jung is clear. By definition, the unconscious is unknowable. It's unknowable. It's unconscious. It's not something we can see hints of it. If a bit like the eddies and swirls on a lake. And the wind blowing on the surface of a lake, we can see these things at the surface level, but we can't see the vast majority of it. And water is a recurring symbol and a recurring theme of dreams, and that these dreams are manifest across society, so they're part of what Jung calls the collective unconscious. And really, that's the, you know, the place where that Nietzsche is actually playing in. If that's the right word, he's actually exploring is this notion of, well, if God is dead, and you know, there is no metaphysical being beyond human experience that can account for human experience, then how do we come up with our morality? Well, whereas Kant argued that there is an inherent process in a kind of metaphysical logic to reality, a function of reason that produces morality internally from human experience. Nietzsche actually kind of pushes that aside and says there isn't that. We are simply animalistic, and we are simply matter and beings, and that to accord a sense of good or evil to our actions and our motives, and a sense of good and evil to the universe and the objects within the universe is actually a misreading of what's there. Yes, he says, we can identify those things which are desirable in terms of at any one point of time laying a claim to an ordered reproduction of our being, or of the what he calls the eternal recurrence. But that is, in a sense, not eternal, because we have to kind of craft that through our experience each time. But we keep repeating these patterns. It's very confusing. I'm kind of grasping at straws when I think about it, and I'm not, you know, not at all well qualified in undertaking this. I did do a kind of a Q&A with ChatGPT last night. And it was an interesting process. It's not sophisticated enough. I asked ChatGPT to act as a professorial advisor or an analyst, a Jungian-style analyst. And it kind of just gives me limited platitudes. It says, yes, you're thinking this way, and that indicates this. And I spoke rather than wrote the response into, and the transcription service on ChatGPT has these transcription AI transcription services are these days is incredible. But I spoke my responses rather than typing, because I wanted to see what a more naturalistic reflection would be like. And it gave me some prompts as to what further consideration might and reflection points, which I'll write up, and they'll accompany this podcast. But it might be argued that they're actually a bit superficial, and that they actually just kind of take it face value. So if you have a list of, you know, it's like describe the contents of your fridge. Well, there's milk and there's cheese and there is some cooked meats and there's some, you know, olives or something like that. But it doesn't give you an indication that you're describing Italian or French cuisine and culture. What it does is it states that these are the objects there. So when it kind of talks about the archetypes, the trickster, the prophet, the different types of archetypal characters that are the professor, that are noted by Nietzsche, it kind of does so on a very superficial kind of way, and it isn't historically contextualized and situated in terms of what Nietzsche's experience, because in a way this is an autobiography of Nietzsche's psyche, and that the thinking that he'd undertaken over a period of time, over a long period of time, where he brought his ideas together in this non-narrative approach. And it's something which is meant to be, and what was useful through the ChatGPT process is thinking about this as a process which is meant to be digested and not arrived at. And this idea of a cyclical understanding. So it's like multiple times, multiple engagements. And I suppose when you think about, you know, those people who are religious and attend churches and temples, they hear the same stories repeatedly, and variations of those stories and interpretations of those stories. And it's not that you go to church and you travel through as a child, you turn up and then you go from A, B, C, D and arrive at the destination point of Z at any particular point. No, it's a cyclical understanding. But when we take on things like philosophical texts, we're often the modern assumption is that is a linear process of understanding, that we can add on these things, and it is part of like laying pontoon sections to form a bridge, and that we can form a bridge across the gap, if you like, the strait which we have to traverse, the chasm that we have to traverse. And actually what I think Nietzsche is the way of understanding the book is to not approach it as that linearity and adding the next stage and the next stage, but actually to keep revisiting it and digesting it and, you know, following a cyclical approach. And part of the understanding is that it's a kind of spiral dynamic where and Jung talks about this in the dream analysis, that understanding comes not in a linear manner, it comes through spirals, and that we repeat, and the eternal recurrence is that we've been here before, and it's like, yeah, well, we're in a slightly different position, we're slightly more conscious of, you know, we remember the past and have lessons from the past and we have emotions that are affected by our memory of the past and our feeling about this. And this comes to this notion of feeling orientation. So Jung describes, he has psychological types, which are kind of in common usage these days, but were groundbreaking, you know, when Jung first wrote about them, as introversion and extroversion, sensing and thinking, and intuition and feeling. And the notion that feeling is very much about, it's not feeling as in terms of emotions. I always love that, repeat this phrase often. Jung says, we don't have emotions, emotions have us. So emotions are different from feelings. Feelings are those things which we are oriented to agreeableness or disagreeableness. Does this fit with us? Is this something which is aligned with our values? Our sense of the purpose that we might have, we have of ourselves, the sense of status that we have of ourselves. If we live in a fragmented world, which I think a lot of modern Western society is massively fragmented, and something I struggle with is cultural and social fragmentation and the feeling of kind of abandonment, if you like, that you're living in times where you know, your own sense of identity is, and your own sense of culture and belonging is being eroded or washed away. And there is this notion of, you know, if you don't have sufficient underpinnings to your abode, and there's a description in the dream analysis book of a dream where the figure who reported the dream was on a seashore, and he was concerned that the waves from the sea would wash away the dunes and the sandbanks. And that, yeah, that's what life is like. Time moves on, and we're not in a fixed, well-grounded position. And then it's a question of what is our capacity to deal with change, and our capacity to feel in accordance with change. And so that sense of feeling of kind of, is this right? Is this justified? Is this, it's a values-based approach to feeling, rather than necessarily an emotional approach to feeling, and the two are different. Emotions are then tied up in a more complex manner in terms of, you know, who and how people are able to express emotions, and in what way emotions, you know, grip us in at any particular point through grief or joy or otherwise. I went to the cinema on last week. I think it was might have been Thursday, and I saw 28 Years Later, and I've blogged about this, and I think it's worth capturing some thoughts about it. But watching the Danny Boyle film, the kind of sequel to 28 Days Later, and it was really interesting from a symbolic and mythological point of view. I won't spoil the plot, other than I hate zombie movies and I hate horror films, because I don't like that feeling of being manipulated. However, this is a very effective, at my level anyway, zombie, you know, I might have low expectations, easily disturbed. But, you know, I don't like the notion of uncovering. Yeah, if you follow the Jungian notion of kind of as within, so without, and as without, so within, then, you know, my fear of horror films and zombie movies and the such like is there must be something within me that I've not dealt with, that kind of can't face this kind of idea of this horror. The sound design is what, so I was sitting there watching it kind of almost with my eyes closed and listening, and when the horrible moments were over, then I could kind of open my eyes, and eventually the kind of film kind of changes its tone halfway through, and it's a relief for me. Other people might not find that in that kind of Disney, you know, kind of theme park ride-esque style of horror movies. It becomes something different. It becomes something very thoughtful around symbolic representation of memory and our place within a symbolic order. And again, without kind of trying to reveal any of the plot for those people who've not seen it, and I would recommend going to see it, there's a point in the film where a character is sought out by the young hero. I mean, the young hero follows the kind of hero's myth motif almost to the letter. You know, it's Alex Garland, the screenwriter, has, you know, kind of really laid out the mythological steps in the kind of classic manner of Joseph Campbell, the hero of a thousand faces, and it is a standard. The first part of the film is a standard hero's journey, and at one point they are crossing a causeway, and they are illuminated by the cosmos, and because there's no light pollution, the representation of the Milky Way in the sky. It's a really great image, but it's accompanied by the opening tones of Das Rheingold, where the Rhine Maidens are introduced at that beginning of the Ring cycle, and that low tone builds up, and it's kind of it adds to the tension. It's done in such a way, and it's a version of that. The music is by the Young Fathers, and they've used, you know, music very carefully to kind of build that moment, and it's kind of like, you know, the return to Valhalla, and it has a lot of references to Nordic, Scandinavian, Viking mythology, and there's a character that emerges who is a, you know, by all intents and purposes a Viking, not a successful one, but an active one at least, And then the film moves into this moment that something happens where there's a transformation takes place, but the transformation isn't without its cost, and it's the handing forward of the female and the responsibility that the young hero has for protecting, letting go of the existing female. So that's his mum. So he goes looking for this doctor who is, he thinks he might be able to cure his mum from whatever malady she's suffering from. But it turns out that he can't. But along the way, they encounter a pregnant zombie who has been impregnated by an alpha male zombie, who is the kind of the key protagonist. And she gives, this pregnant zombie gives birth in a very graphic way to a child, a daughter, who is not infected by the zombie virus. So it opens up an interesting branch of the story to how people move forward, and that there might be, you know, other children born in this way who are not subject to the virus and subject to the degradation and the bestiality, if you like, of what the virus causes. So you've got this balance and this relationship between the civilized and the uncivilized, the natural and the bestial, and order and chaos. And then there's a figure, which is the guy played, it's a doctor character played by Ralph Fiennes, who, you know, quite literally could have come out of Heart of Darkness. And I think that's a deliberate, you know, it's like, you know, a deliberate nod towards Apocalypse Now. And this figure who maintains a fire, but in all of the chaos and the disorder, commemorates the dead and builds structures from the bones of the dead, and so that there's a kind of a I suppose in a classic sense he's the mystical figure, he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi, he's the wizard, he's the Gandalf type figure who instructs and initiates the boy from being a child to a man. And there's a point where the boy protects the Ralph Fiennes figure, this doctor figure, and he becomes the protagonist of the story, of his own story, and he can then move forward, and he moves on to kind of rescue this baby and to takes it back to the island village that he departed from, and then he moves away and he goes and follows his own path and his own journey. And so it was just one of those films that when you kind of actually sat down and watched it, you look at it from a mythological perspective and think it's not subtle. It isn't as subtle as in the sense of it's not kind of degradations of subtle shades of colour. It's of pastel shades. It's painted in broad colours and contrasting motifs. But it is quite, you know, kind of interesting that it goes. And the other thing it plays with is the notion of memory. So the idea that there is a halt to society in 2002 when the first film was set, and that the culture has just been, you know, it ended in that period, and it's the UK has been isolated, and the rest of Europe holds the UK, the rest of the world holds the UK in quarantine. Nobody can get in, nobody can get out, and so the world has gone on without the UK, and the UK is returning back to its kind of naturalistic state. So you've got this added element to this about selective memory. And Garland, in some interviews that I quickly looked at, you know, kind of says this is a motif of the film, that, you know, it's about how we can project false memory onto things. We can pull all of these things together, if you like, and we can create a sense, a false sense of what the past was about, both for good or ill, is that there was a society. Archaeologically, we can dig into this. And I suppose from a Jungian point of view, that is the, you know, I think I said last week, Jung, as well as being a great psychologist and healer, was a great archaeologist of the symbolic. He knew cultural motifs and religious and, pagan and, things like alchemy and astronomy. He knew these things well enough to be able to read in Latin and Hebrew and Greek. So he was very astute. But at the same time, there's a sense there that you can reconstruct a past on a false memory basis, and that you can believe that the times of the Roman period were, bestial, and the times of the modern period are civilized, and it's not, it doesn't bear out in terms of practical understanding of how people lived in those situations and those times. So it kind of has that element to it, which is ties in with Nietzsche, because Jung was influenced by Nietzsche, and this is what I want to get on to, hopefully reading Jung's notes about Nietzsche in terms of how this is situated and how we make sense of it now, because we live in a time where making sense of these things is quite challenging at the moment, and quite problematic in many ways, because parts of culture, kind of our culture are prioritized over other parts of our culture, and there's a due deference and respect to guest cultures, which is almost coming at the expense of host cultures. And so we forget and we sideline or we minimize the importance of the host culture and the traditions of the host culture and the problems of the host culture. Is not to say that we don't look at their problems, but we minimize them at our peril, and that we have to have a kind of cultural memory, because we are subject to the eternal return. And one of the things to get on to thinking about is this notion of the Übermensch, and the notion that maybe I heard a really good description saying that actually a retranslation of what was meant, what Nietzsche meant, it could be better understood as thinking about the meta man, is that you have the capacity to understand and incorporate all of these prior elements of pre-modern, modern, post-modern thinking into a meta-modern, where you understand the different, you have these things incorporated within your consciousness, that you understand that there are different levels and different elements of consciousness that you have access to, and that the Übermensch is the person who can traverse across those, who see, can hold them and look at them and kind of use what's valuable in each. But I don't know enough about that at this point. Anyway, I've been chatting now for 30 minutes. Gosh, that time went quickly. I will keep maintaining a note of what I'm reading. I will keep trying to find the time to sit and record these thoughts. And if anybody wants to have a conversation or a discussion, if you catch this at any point, do let me know. It's you can contact me, rob@robwatsonmedia.net. I almost forgot then. And the website is robwatsonmedia.net, and social media is robwmedia. But until next time, thank you very much. And I'm now going to go and sit and have a cold drink somewhere and maybe buy myself an ice cream.
This has been Distraction Therapy, where ideas wander, symbols speak, and insight emerges in time. To follow the journey, visit robwatsonmedia.net or follow on socials at robwmedia. Until next time, stay with the questions.